Dr. Michael Roizen.
Dr. Michael Roizen.
You, the Owner's Manual Radio Show.
This is Dr. Mike Roizen. You're listening to You, the Owner's Manual Radio Show, and we have a sensational guest for you. Sarah Gray, a donor mother's powerful memory or memoir of grief and rebirth that is also a fascinating medical science whodunit, a life everlasting, the extraordinary story of one boy's gift to medical science. Yes, this book will take you inside the world of organ, eye, tissue, blood donation, and cutting-edge scientific research. So, Sarah, tell us how you're related to this and how you got involved in this.
Hi, Dr. Mike. Nice to meet you. Unfortunately, when I was about 12 weeks pregnant, I went to get a sonogram, and I learned that though I was having identical twins, one was going to live and one was not going to live. He had a diagnosis called anencephaly.
So anencephaly means it's a terminal condition. It's without a brain or most mm-hmm. of the brain mm-hmm. or a large part of it. Mm-hmm. So that must have shocked you an awful lot.
Yeah, we weren't expecting anything like this. And it was even more confusing because they were genetically identical. Have you ever heard of anything like this in your experience?
No. So you did something extraordinary. So there's more than one part of this story that is extraordinary.
Yeah.
To be able to bring up the other child is extraordinary, but also to look at the everlasting life of this one. And what do you mean? And the book is titled, we should say, A Life Everlasting. Tell us what you mean by that.
Sure. Well, after I had the twins and my son Thomas died after 6 days, we decided to donate his body to science, so to medical and scientific research.
So Thomas's organs went to science.
Yes. Yeah.
And there obviously is a period of probably extraordinary grieving. Mm-hmm. I mean, I can't even imagine that. And your other son, your twin son, is now, six?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's doing great. He's healthy. And we just had a new baby 3 months ago. I have a baby girl now.
Oh, congratulations.
Thanks.
So now tell me how did this book come about? I know the answers, but I'm trying to let our listeners not know all the answers right away. So okay. Tell us what happened then.
Okay. So after we donated his corneas, retinas, liver, and blood to medical research.
So you donated his corneas, mm-hmm. his liver, mm-hmm. his blood, mm-hmm. and
retina.
One other. Say it again.
Retina.
And retina mm-hmm. To medical science. Then what happened?
I was curious about who these researchers were and what they were doing with these donations from my son.
And when did you get that curiosity? In other words, how long did it take?
I was curious from the beginning, probably, but it wasn't until maybe 6 months later we attended a grief counseling session with a bunch of other people who had donated for transplant. And I noticed that a lot of these people who donated for transplant, they could communicate and correspond with their loved one's recipient. And I was jealous. I was like, oh, I want to correspond with my son's recipient, but my son's recipient is a researcher. It's, you know, it wasn't, his organs were not surgically implanted into someone else. They were mailed and received at a lab.
Well, and that's because they were so, if you will, early in life that mm-hmm. they aren't used for that at that point in time.
That's right. He was too small. He did not meet the criteria, the weight criteria, and he wasn't big enough to donate for transplant. I contacted
I contacted the
organ procurement organization where I live in Washington, D.C., and I asked them could they provide any information about, like, the researcher's name or the type of study or if anything had been published. And they said no, that they weren't really accustomed to giving that kind of information. No one had ever asked for it before. So I sort of let it go. But a year later, I went to Boston for a business trip. which was kind of unusual. I didn't normally go to Boston, but I remembered that my son's corneas went to Harvard Medical School. So I just looked up the Scapin's Eye Research Institute, which is the part of Harvard Medical School that got my son's corneas, and I decided to cold call them and see if I could come for a tour.
So you're now in Boston. You go for a tour at the Eye Institute that got the corneas or the retina. I don't know
the cornea.
Which. The cornea. And then what happened?
I was able to meet a professor of ophthalmology who is one of the people that requests corneas. So this could be the guy that received my son's corneas. And I was so emotional meeting him, and I think he was emotional meeting me too. And he said, you know, we've never had somebody like you visit us before. And he thanked me for the donation. Yeah. It was a little bit of a shock. But he thanked me for the donation, and he said, do you have any questions? He was really open and, you know, generous with me. And I said, how many corneas do you request?
Well, of course, you had been generous with science, if you will. So you're the one who we really feel had the generosity. But anyway, he spent some time with you, and then he said, and then you asked him, how many corneas do you get?
Yeah, I mean, all I really wanted to know was this donation worthwhile? Was it useful? Was it worth the effort that we went through to do it? Because I had never done anything like this before, and I had no frame of reference. And so I said, do you request, you know, one or two of these a year, or do you get, like, thousands? Are my son's corneas, like, sitting on a shelf collecting dust, or are you really excited and using them right away? And he said that they were extremely valuable, and that his lab requests about 10 pairs a year, but they would request more if they could, and that infant corneas were like gold to them. They were so rare. And he said that they also have the potential to regenerate in the lab so they can, you know, study them on more than one project. And he said, how long ago did your son die? And I said, he died about 2 years ago. And he said, well, we're likely still studying your son's eye cells right now, and you're probably in the presence of your son's eye cells in this lab right now.
Wow.
I got my answer,
Yeah, not only that, but I would have broken down at that point.
I was on verge, yeah.
So that was the first,
yeah.
But you didn't stop there.
Well, it was such a good experience. I really felt that I was afraid to call them initially. I was afraid that I wouldn't be welcome or they would think I was some kind of weirdo. But it was such a good experience and gave me so much peace that I decided to try, at least try, to visit the three other facilities.
And we are talking to Sarah Gray, G-R-A-Y. The book is A Life Everlasting, The Extraordinary Story of One Boy's Gift to Medical Science. And if you will, this is exactly what it sounds like. Not only this great information about medical science in here, which obviously attracts me, but the empathy for that is shown for science and for the future lives is extraordinary. I guess that is the extraordinary story, but it's also a whodunit. So what did you then do to get to the next organ, and where'd you go?
I contacted the Organ Procurement Organization, the Washington Regional Transplant Community, and I explained to them what I had just done in Boston, and I think I shocked them. They had never heard of someone doing this before, and they might have been a little scared for me, and they said, oh, you know, those researchers are not trained to talk to people like you. Was he nice to you? Were they nice to you? And I said, yeah, they were fantastic. And, you know, I was so enthused. I'm like, can you set me up with some appointments and, you know, meet the people that got the liver? And they said, sure, we'll give it a shot. Now that you've done it once and had a good experience, maybe we can keep this rolling. So they were successful, and they set up an appointment for us to visit Cytonet. This time I brought my husband and Callum, the twin. But it was only a 5-hour drive from where we live in Durham. So we just went on a road trip, and we visited the president of Cytonet and along with a lot of the lab staff there.
And this is a offshoot of Duke?
No, it's actually it's like a biotech firm they're actually a for-profit company. The other donations went to nonprofit companies. But this is an organization that is trying to develop treatments for liver disease, especially one called urea cycle defect.
Gotcha, which is a congenital liver disease where the childs have a lot of trouble functioning. The kids do, and do not do well long term. Go ahead. There is a specific diet for it, actually. But go ahead. So what happened?
I was able to meet the woman who held my son's liver in her hands when it arrived. And they had also said that they had never met a donor family like mine before, but they were curious. You know, the same way that I was curious about them, they were wondering about people like me, you know.
And what? Tell us a little bit more about that experience.
Sure. Do you want me to talk about what happens at CytoNet?
Sure, whatever to do.
Yeah, sure. So CytoNet gets offered about 200 livers every month from around the country. But they only select the healthiest 8. You know, people who are not overweight and didn't drink a lot of alcohol throughout their life. And what they do is they take the solid liver and they put an enzyme on it that basically melts kind of the glue that holds the cells together. So they get a pile of hepatic cells or liver cells. And then they inject these cells into a baby that has urea cycle defect. And these cells act like a healthy liver and keep the baby alive while the baby is waiting on a transplant. You know, maybe they're too small, or maybe the liver's not available.
So
this is a bridge therapy.
What we call a bridge to transplant.
Yeah.
So, and they can do this. In other words, one liver the size of Thomas's can do this to how many people? Or with this?
I think the number was 6 the last time that I asked about that, but I'm not exactly sure.
And so how did your husband and your then, I guess, 3-year-old son react?
Callum was 3, so he was just kind of playing all over the place and running around. But my husband was impressed as well, though my husband is not as impressed as I am. He, you know, he just kind of wanted to go to support me, and he wanted to see the Durham Stadium. But he saw how much it meant to me to meet these people.
And, was that the Durham baseball stadium or the Durham basketball stadium?
I think it was the baseball one. The Durham Bulls, yeah.
Right, the Durham Bulls play in a baseball stadium that's relatively unique.
Oh,
okay. Was in an old tobacco warehouse.
Oh,
so,
cool.
So anyway, it's a much better use for it now.
Well, he wanted to see that. I wanted to see CytoNet, but we compromised. We saw both.
But then you went, you kept going. You didn't stop there.
Yes. I was able to set up an appointment at Duke University Center for Human Genetics, where they received the blood, the cord blood of both twins, and blood from me and my husband, because it was a good control study to study, you know, if twins are genetically identical, why does one have anencephaly and one doesn't? And I learned that they did a poster for a conference comparing this blood sample. Of course, they couldn't say for sure that it was our twins because of confidentiality, but they could say that it was very rare for them to get a sample like this. And it was around the time that we donated the sample that the study came out, so kind of put 2 and 2 together that, you know, this is likely our twins' blood. But they found 1,000 epigenetic differences between the twins. So that's the thing.
Epigenetics, so that people do understand that, because we talk about it a lot on this program. Epigenetics are not the genes themselves, but whether the genes are turned on or not by what we call some controllers. Those controllers are simply what we call methyl donors, or another, if you will, carbon atom there, and to see whether the code skips over those genes or goes to those genes, whether they're active or inactive. So that's what epigenetic changes usually mean. And that's what they found in 1,000 of them in just the cord blood, I assume, of the two children.
Yes. And I asked the grad student who was working on this if she was surprised by what she saw. And she said, for me to be surprised, that implies I knew what to expect, which I didn't. She said, we're just at the very beginning learning about this field of epigenetics.
And that's exactly right. Epigenetics is probably now about 8 years old in total. Mm-hmm. Some people would say it's much older than that, but it really isn't. It's about 8 years old. It's only in the last 2 or 3 years we've appreciated how much control each of us have over whether our genes are on or not. That's how physical activity helps you get well, or doing a game like Double Decision helps you have a prevent dementia over a 10-year period that we've talked about earlier in the show. We are talking with Sarah Gray, A Life Everlasting. Sarah, before I forget, and I want to get into the last story, but before I forget, The Life Everlasting, tell us what the website is for that.
Oh, sure. It's sarahgray.com, SARAHGRAY.com.
And this is a wonderful book. It's that both medically in fun and a whodunit. So the last one took you to where my son does research in pediatric endocrinology. So hopefully if you did meet him, he was nice. But in any case, it's the University of Pennsylvania.
I visited the genetics lab. So I don't think I got to meet your son, not this time at least. But I got to visit the lab where the retinas ended up. And it was incredible because the woman who received them, Dr. Arupa Ganguly, explained that she's studying retinoblastoma, which is a cancer of the retina, and she needed some healthy tissue to compare with the diseased tissue. And she explained that she had been waiting for 6 years to receive a sample of tissue like the one that Thomas was able to provide. So there's a waiting list, which surprised me.
So she studies retinoblastoma, mm-hmm. which is an eye cancer that attacks young children. And so hopefully this will help do things that uncover both the mechanism and work towards a solution of that.
Yeah, hopefully. So I was just surprised that she waited so long.
So one of the things that is impressive in this story of A Life Everlasting is how many people, one, you didn't find anyone wasted any of these tissues or stored them for the future. These were needed. Mm-hmm. And secondly, that it does give, if you will, your son a life everlasting. And I guess it gives your current son, who's 6 years old, is his name
Callum.
Callum. Mm-hmm. I want to call him Callum, but Callum. Mm-hmm. Callum, a twin that is still existing and may help other people.
Yeah, I suppose you could put it that way. He's definitely still contributing, and he's still relevant to researchers around the country.
So if we were to take, other than the fun I had in reading the book and the medical whodunit that you did and the breaking of the barriers, what do you think was, if you went back and said, I would do this again or I wouldn't do this again, I take it from the book you would do it again, mm-hmm. but what was so surprising, what was the most surprising to you?
I would definitely do it again. The most surprising was how valuable each donation was. I hoped that they would be a little bit valuable, and they were much more valuable than I had even dared to dream.
I think what is so surprising to me is there were four chances for medical science to not do right.
Right.
And in every case, it did right. Mm-hmm. And to me, that's what, when I've been in, although I do this radio show and although we write stuff that people can use to stay well, because I was exposed, I spent some time at NIH during the Vietnam era and spent my life doing medical research, and that's why I love this, because I get to read articles and read books, and I'm a medical nerd, if you will. But to me, one of the great things about medical science is the treasure that we take, the importance and the, if you will, focus that we have on doing right for humanity and on making humanity better. And this book really shows that. It is a tribute not only to you and to the generosity that you and your husband showed, and to Callum, and to Thomas, obviously, but also I look at it as this is a real example of medical science continuing to do right. The book is by Sarah Gray. It's at sarahgray.com, A Life Everlasting. Please do get it and enjoy it the way I have. Thanks very much, Sarah.
Thank you, Dr. Mike.
Thank you. You've been listening to Podcast 810 on You, the Owner's Manual Radio Show. We released this on 10/18/16. I hope you enjoy it time and time again. This story, A Life Everlasting, fits with many of the others that we show and talk about on the show, because it is what we're all after, age-proofing ourselves, getting better at making life better for more people. Tune in next week, 7 a.m. on 1025. We will release another, what I call, great podcast. This time we're going to talk about our guest. We have a lot of subjects to talk about. I'm not even going to tell you what the great medical advances are for the week, because I don't know them yet, because as you know, I read 50 medical articles a week, because that's what I love doing. I'm a medical nerd. So I can't tell you what the breaking medical stories are we'll cover, but I can tell you our guests, George Lynn and Cynthia Johnson, authors of Breaking the Trance, A Practical Guide for Parenting the Screen-Dependent Child and Screen Dependency in Children, will be our topic. Thanks very much for tuning in. Get the next podcast. Rate us while you're there. Tell them whether you like us or not. And if you want to ask us questions, suggest guests, or tell us what we can do better, please do. Just say, "For Dr. Mike's podcast," as the subject line, and send it to UDOCS, YOUDOCS, @gmail.com. YOUDOCS@gmail.com. Thanks again.